Hello, it's Debbie again. This is part two for the Wednesday, November 4th, 2015, for the Herald and Review. And as tradition, we start part two with the death notices. Rubatum, Hetty P. Decatur, Hetty P. Rubatum, 89, of Decatur, went to be with her Lord and Savior on Monday, November 2nd. At Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services to celebrate Hetty's life will be at 10 a.m. Friday, November 6th, at Marantha Assembly of God on Imboden Drive in Decatur. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 p.m. Thursday, November 5th, at the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home. Private burial will be at the Camp Butler National Cemetery. Memorials are suggested to the Grace House, 851 East Cantrell Street in Decatur. The family of Hetty P. Rubatum is being served by the Graceland Fairlawn Funeral Home on Oakland in Decatur. Decatur, Smith, Randy Dean. Randy Dean Smith, 61, of Glassford, passed away at 6:20 p.m. Sunday, November 1st at OSF St. Francis Medical Center in Peoria. His funeral will be at 10:30 a.m. Friday, November 6th, at Glassford Baptist Church in Glassford. Pastor Wayne Yeager will officiate. Visitation will be from 5 to 7 Thursday at the church. Burial will be at the Lancaster Cemetery in Glassford. Arrangements are being handled by the Preston Hanley Funeral Home and Crematory in Pekin. In lieu of flowers, memorial contributions may be given to the American Cancer Society, 4234 North Knoxville Avenue, Peoria. Mount Auburn. Stephen R. Keefe. Stephen R. Keefe, 57, of Mount Auburn, died Monday, November 2nd, 2015. Special thanks to St. John's Hospice Care for taking wonderful care of him during his final days. End of that short death notice. Mount Zion, Brabender, Thomas W. Tom Brabender, 75, of Mount Zion, passed away Monday, November 2nd, at Aspen Creek in Sullivan, Illinois. The family wishes to express their heartfelt thanks to the Aspen Creek for their love and support through this difficult time. Condolences may be left in the family in care of the Brittler and Earl Funeral Home. Taylorville. Curtin, William Curtin. William Colbrook Curtin, 91, of Taylorville, passed away 2 p.m. on Monday, November 2nd, at Meadow Manor Nursing Home in Taylorville. A Mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, November 5th, tomorrow, at St. Mary Catholic Church with Father Mariatis Chotla officiating. Visitation will be tonight, Wednesday, November 4th, from 5 to 7 at McClure Funeral Home. Burial will take place in Oak Hill Cemetery, Taylorville, with military honors given by the Stonington American Legion and the Assumption VFW. Memorials may be made in his honor to St. Mary Catholic School of Taylorville or Holy Trinity Altar and Rosary Society of Stonington. McClure Funeral Home of Taylorville is assisting the family with arrangements. Decatur, Roger Dale. Roger Dale Spurlock, 75 years old, walked peacefully into the arms of Jesus on Saturday morning, October 31st, 2015, at his home, surrounded by family. Visitation and funeral service to celebrate and honor Roger's life will be held at First Christian Church with visitation scheduled Sunday, November 8th, from 5 to 8 p.m., and funeral services on Monday, November 9th, beginning at 11 a.m. Burial will be at Graceland Cemetery, Decatur. Memorials may be made to the Good Samaritan Inn, 920 North Union Street in Decatur. Tanzius Logan Funeral Services and Care is in charge of the arrangements. Decatur, Palmer, Betty Jean. Betty Jean Palmer, 80, of Decatur, departed this life on Sunday, November 1st, at Decatur Memorial Hospital. Services celebrating her life will be at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 7th, with visitation 1 hour before, at the Church of the Living God Temple, number 1, burial, Graceland Cemetery, professional services entrusted to Walker, funeral service. That is the end of the obituaries for today, Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. Because this is on the obituary page, I will read this. Out of Montpelier, Vermont, the headline says, Bernie's Briefs for Sale. Employees of a Vermont company have launched a side business selling underwear featuring a black and white drawing of the face of Democratic presidential candidate Bernie Sanders. NECN reports that the underwear, which features the message Feel the Burn, B-E-R-N, is available for men and women and costs $15 plus shipping and handling. The three workers with KSC Partners, a strategic communication and government affairs firm, said they created Bernie's Briefs as a fun side business. The Vermont senator had recently said on late-night TV and talk shows that he preferred briefs over boxers. The startup's founders called Sanders' passion for serious issues admirable. One founder said the political process has benefited from his campaign. 10% of the proceeds will go toward the Yellow Ribbon Fund, which supports injured service members. End of that page. Continuing back to the A section of the paper, Section A, state, AP, broken systems let problem officers jump from job to job. Law enforcement officers accused of sexual misconduct have jumped from job to job and at times face fresh allegations that include raping women because of a tattered network of laws and lax screening that allowed them to stay on the beat. A year-long Associated Press investigation into sex abuse by cops, jail guards, deputies, and other state law enforcement officials uncovered a broken system for policing bad officers with significant flaws in how agencies deal with those suspected of sexual misconduct and glaring warning signals that go unreported or get overlooked. The AP examination found that about 1,000 officers in 6 years who lost their licenses because of sex crimes that included rape or sexual misconduct, ranging from propositioning citizens to consensual but prohibited on-duty intercourse. That number fails to reflect the breadth of the problem, however, because it measures only officers who faced an official process called decertification, and not all states have such a system or provided records. In states that do revoke law enforcement licenses, the process can take years, and while there is a national index of decertified officers contributing to its voluntary and experts say the database, which is not open to the public, is missing thousands of names. Oh, contributing to it is voluntary, and experts say the database, which is not open to the public, is missing thousands of names. Some officers are permitted to quietly resign and never even face decertification. Others are able to keep working because departments may not be required to report all misdeeds to a state police standards commission, or they neglect to. Agencies may also not check references when hiring or fail to share past problems with new employers. In 2010, a woman sued the Grand Junction Police Department in Colorado, insisting the department erred in hiring Officer Glenn Coyne and then failed to supervise him. Coyne was fired and killed himself days after he was arrested on suspicion of raping the woman in September 2019. I'll go through a bunch of the different specific cases. Police Standards Agency, if going toward the end, police standards agencies in 44 states can revoke the licenses of problem officers, which should prevent a bad cop from moving on to police work elsewhere. But 6 states, including New York and California, have no decertification authority over officers who commit misconduct. And in states with decertification powers, virtually every police standards agency relies on local departments to investigate and report questionable conduct. Those reporting requirements vary, said Roger Goldman, an expert on police licensing. About 20 states can decertify an officer only after a criminal conviction. Consider the variations between Pennsylvania and Florida. In Pennsylvania, the state agency responsible for police certification reported just 20 revocations from 2009 through 2014, none for sex-related crimes or misconduct. Florida decertified 2,125 officers in those 6 years, some 162 for sex-related misconduct. End of article. Continuing on with the state, pilot project lets investors fund Illinois social services. Out of Chicago, AP. The state of Illinois is launching a pilot project of a public-private partnership that would have investors pay for services to people in need in exchange for a potential return on investment. The project, set to launch Tuesday, gives investors the opportunity to cover upfront costs of services and to be reimbursed with a profit if the program meets objectives to improve outcomes and save the state money. Former Democratic Governor Pat Quinn first commissioned the project, and it has support by his successor, Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. The program could be a model for funding social services and give providers more certainty that the state budgeting process, the Chicago Tribune reports. All right, let's do that sentence again. The program could be a model for funding social services and give providers more certainty than the state budgeting process, the Chicago Tribune reports. State officials say details about the project structure, costs, and measures for success will be sorted out in the coming months. An agreement over the state budget has eluded state leaders for months now. Some bills are being paid through court orders in state law, and lawmakers and state employees are collecting their salaries. But local governments aren't getting their share of gasoline taxes or state gambling receipts. Human service agencies that contract with Illinois aren't getting paid or are getting partial payments months late. Wealthier communities with a stronger property tax base and cash reserves have gotten by, though even they are warning of serious consequence ahead. Many places in the state's poor southern region, however, have no cushion. The Department of Children and Family Services will focus the pilot program on youth in four counties who are in child welfare and juvenile delinquency systems. Private investors will cover upfront costs of services that could save the state money by reducing recidivism and further preparing children for adulthood. Investors would absorb the loss if the program doesn't meet objectives. It is an exciting opportunity for our state and provides us with a way to save money, be more effective, and better serve you, said Andrew Flack, a spokesman for DCFS. Instead of just writing checks, we're ensuring we're getting outcomes we're asking for. Flack said the possible rate of return for investors hasn't been determined. He said the program wouldn't cost the state more than it already pays. Harvard Kennedy School professor Jeff Liebman said the model is, quote, like a money-back guarantee for taxpayers, unquote. But Elizabeth Lower Bosch, a public policy expert at the Center for Law and Social Policy, wrote in a paper that this mechanism, quote, imposes costs beyond the cost of providing services. If you can make a case that convinces investment bankers it'll pay for itself, you ought to be able to convince the public it'll pay for itself and just pay for it, Laura Bosch said in an interview. The program is among other so-called social impact bond initiatives across the country. Chicago launched a program last year using nearly $17 million in such bond to enroll more low-income children in pre-kindergarten. End of the article. Another article from the AP State, Palatine, district defends privacy curtains for transgender girl. Educators in a suburban Chicago school district said Tuesday they believe they've forged a creative accommodation for a transgender student who wants unrestricted access to a girl's high school locker room, and they're prepared to go to court to defend it. Installing curtains in the locker room for the student who was born male and identifies as female balances the privacy rights of the other girls with the student's wishes to be treated equally, said Superintendent Daniel Cates of Township School District 211. Cates spoke to the Associated Press one day after the U.S. Department of Education's Office of Civil Rights declared the district in violation of federal law for offering the student only separate changing facilities. The district could lose up to $6 million in federal funding if it can't reach a deal with the agency, which has said the privacy curtains are discriminatory unless all the girls are required to use them. The transgender student has not been identified and wants to remain anonymous, according to the ACLU of Illinois, which helped the girls' parents file a complaint more than 2 years ago. She's been living as a girl since middle school, has changed her legal name, obtained a passport as a female, received a diagnosis of gender dysphoria, and is taking female hormones, according to the Department of Education's summary of its investigation. The school district has allowed the student to use the girls' restrooms and to participate in girls' athletics. She's identified as a female in the district's computer system. But the district drew a line when it came to locker rooms, requiring the girl to use private restrooms to change into her gym uniform or into a swimsuit for a required swim unit. Kate said other transgender students in all five district high schools abide by the current policy. Last month, during the federal investigation, the school district installed five privacy screens in a girl's locker room and has stated it required the transgender student to use the curtains. Similar cases are being fought in state and federal courts, and it's not the first time the feds have weighed in. In July, the U.S. Justice Department said in a court filing that transgender students must be allowed to use the restroom that corresponds with their gender identity, and failure to do so amounts to sex discrimination under Title IX of the U.S. Education Amendments of 1972. The filing was in response to a federal lawsuit filed in Virginia against the Gloucester County School Board by a 16-year-old transgender student who wants to use the boys' restroom. But Francisco Negrin, general counsel at the National School Boards Association, said Title IX is not as explicit as the government contends, and there's very little precedent in case law. Rapidly changing social norms are ahead of the legal framework, Negrin said, leaving school districts in jeopardy of losing federal funding if they go against the government. Both sides may push this case into the courts. Advocates for the girl say her case is important to advance transgender rights. Educators insist schools must have the flexibility to come up with creative solutions. The federal government's letter to the district suggests privacy curtains could be a solution if all girls, not the transgender student, use them and if they were available widely. Negotiations are continuing between the school district and the government. School leaders everywhere could be navigating this soon, Kate said. End of the article. In A6, politics, GOP wins Kentucky governor's race in top state election. Kentucky voters on Tuesday elected just the second Republican in four decades to hold the governor's office in a race that hinged largely on President Barack Obama's signature legislation, the Affordable Care Act. The result was a potentially troubling sign for Democrats ahead of next year's presidential election and represented a big win for the GOP as it continues to consolidate political power across the South. Democrats also were thumped in Virginia, where they made a big push to win a majority in one chamber of the state legislature. The governor's race in Kentucky was the highest profile contest in Tuesday's off-year elections. The only other gubernatorial campaign was in Mississippi, where Republican Governor Phil Bryant won re-election. Elsewhere, Ohio voters rejected an initiative that sought to legalize the recreational and medicinal use of marijuana. And Houston voters defeated an ordinance that would have established non-discrimination protections for gay and transgender people in the city. In Kentucky, Republican business Matt Bevin had waged a campaign to scale back the state's Medicaid expansion that had made it was made possible under the federal health care overhaul. Some 400,000 lower-income people who gained health coverage under the expansion could be affected. The Republican also played up his support for Kim Davis, the Rowan County clerk jailed for refusing to issue marriage license to same-sex couples. His Democratic opponent, two-term Attorney General Jack Conway, embraced Obama's health care reform, saying hundreds of thousands of residents could lose access to taxpayer-funded insurance if Bevin won. Around the country, several high-profile ballot initiatives tested voter preference on school funding, marijuana, gay and lesbian rights, and the sharing economy. Despite the relatively low number of races, the results could be an important bellwether of sentiment ahead of next year's presidential elections. In Virginia, a swing state, Democrats failed in an expensive bid to take control of the state Senate and power Democratic Governor Terry McAuliffe in negotiations with Republicans who control the state House. The governor's race in Mississippi was overshadowed by a fight over a constitutional amendment that would allow people to sue the state to increase funding for public schools. Critics say it would take budget decisions away from Mississippi lawmakers and give the courts too much power. The legislature has put forward its own ballot measure that would prohibit judicial enforcement of school funding. The outcome could prompt similar efforts in other states where education remains a key challenge for lawmakers as they look to balance their budget with tax revenues that have yet to rebound from pre-recession levels. In Houston, the nation's fourth largest city, efforts to secure non-discrimination protections for gay and transgender people failed. Now that same-sex marriage is legal, such laws have become a priority for gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender groups. Opponents, including a coalition of conservative pastors, said the measure would have infringed on their religious beliefs. Houston voters also were choosing from among 13 candidates to replace outgoing Mayor Anise Parker. It was one of more than 300 mayoral races happening across the country. In Philadelphia, former longtime Councilman Jim Kenney was elected mayor on a promise to fight poverty and push for universal pre-kindergarten education. The Salt Lake City mayoral race featured two-term incumbent Ralph Becker, one of President Barack's appointees on the Climate Change Task Force, and former state lawmaker Jackie Biskupski. If Biskupski wins, she'll be the city's first openly gay city manager. AP out of New York, under entertainment, teens spend an average of 9 hours a day with media. Teenagers spend nearly 9 hours a day observing media, and despite all the new options, music and television remain the favorites. Common Sense Media released an exhaustive survey Tuesday outlining how young people spend screen time. One concern, the number of youngsters who feel comfortable multitasking while doing homework. Two-thirds of teenagers say they listen to music every day, and 58% said the same about watching TV, the study said. By contrast, 45% reported using social media every day, and only 36% said they enjoyed that activity a lot. Twice as many said they really enjoyed their music. Television is the favorite activity of teenagers in training, with 62% respondents aged 8 to 12 saying they watched every day, the study said. Tweens said they spent just under 6 hours a day on media time. Exactly half of the time teenagers spend with a video involves watching a TV program at the time it originally airs. The rest is parceled out among time-delayed viewing, DVDs, and online video, the study said. Another AP out of New York. A national survey. Religious Americans keep faith amid secularization. A survey released Tuesday brought some good news for faith leaders alarmed by the spike in the number of Americans who say they have no ties to a particular religion. U.S. adults who continue to identify with a faith group, about 77% of all Americans, have largely stayed as religiously engaged as they were 7 years ago, according to the Pew Research Center, evidence of a solid core of committed faithful who remain a bulwark against secularization. Two-thirds of a religiously affiliated adult said last year that faith was very important to them and they prayed daily, nearly unchanged from 2007, the last time Pew conducted its U.S. religious landscape study. About 6 in 10 said they attended worship services at least once or twice a month, a rate similar to years before, and nearly all said they believed in God, although the study found a slight dip in the percentage who said so with absolute certainty. So this is, they're talking about percentages of the 77% who say they are religiously engaged. By other measures, the religiously affiliated are more devoted than they were years before. A higher percentage say they regularly read scriptures, participate in small prayer study groups, and share their faith with others. 46% said they believe their faith traditions should preserve traditional beliefs and practices in face of the changes in modern society, up slightly from 7 years ago. Pew released the findings based in part on a 2014 telephone survey of more than 35,000 people as religious leaders are grappling with the shifting makeup of American religious life, including the end of what was once a Protestant majority and shrinking membership in denominations ranging from liberal mainline churches to the conservative Southern Baptist Convention. In a recent release of data last May, Pew researchers found that Americans who don't affiliate with a religion have become the second largest group in total numbers behind evangelicals, comprising nearly 23% of U.S. adults. Within that group, dubbed nuns, a N-O-N-E-S, nun, A growing share describe themselves as atheist or agnostic, making the country less religious overall. At the same time, the report found growing strength among evangelicals. The growing number of evangelicals rose to 62 million people, or a quarter of the population, and evangelicals were the only major Christian group between 2007 and 2014 to gain more members than they lost, Pew researchers said. Among major faith traditions, the level of commitment varies. Still, Pew found broad evidence of a stable or slightly increased commitment to faith among those who identified with particular religion, including among Roman Catholics, liberal Protestants, and Jews. Regarding politics, the study found a widening religion split between the major political parties. People with no religion ties are now the largest group of Democrat Party members, and those who lean Democratic, comprising 28% of the coalition, compared to 19% in 2007. The trend raises challenges for Democrats. 62% of nuns said they were absolutely certain they were registered to vote, compared to 71% who identified with a religion. Evangelicals remain the largest religious group in the GOP, and for those who lean Republican, making up 38% of GOP supporters. The survey also found nearly every major religion was noticeably more accepting of same-sex relationships, including among groups that have been most vocally opposed to gay marriage. The change is driven strongly by younger generations. For example, half of the millennials who say they are evangelical say homosexuality should be accepted by society, the survey found. Pew's telephone survey, conducted June 4th through September 30th, 2014, has an overall margin of error of plus or minus less than 1 percentage point, although the margin of errors is higher for findings on individual religious traditions. End of that article. A quick note from Section B on sports. Clemson tops first rankings of committee. AP New York. Clemson, LSU, Ohio State, and Alabama are the top four teams in the first college football playoff selection committee rankings of the season. Notre Dame was fifth and Baylor was sixth on Tuesday night. Clemson, LSU, and Ohio State are among 11 unbeaten teams in FBS, nearly quadruple the number that was last season when the committee started ranking teams. Alabama and Notre Dame each have one loss. Memphis was the highest-ranked team from Group of Five Conference at number 13. Last year, the top four teams in the first playoff rankings were Mississippi State, Florida State, Auburn, and Mississippi. Only the Seminoles reached the playoff. Ohio State, the eventual national champion, was 16th in the first ranking. Takeaways from the first... Oh, that's the end of that. An article out of Washington, AP. Hello, policy fights on spending bill. Buy budget goodwill. BYE, budget goodwill. Despite a broad budget deal, fights over Planned Parenthood, the environment, and other policy issues still threaten a spending bill to keep the government running, reviving the possibility of a holiday season shutdown. The goodwill that emerged from a bipartisan budget and debt bill that President Barack Obama signed into law on Monday could be short-lived. Filling in the details of $66 billion, in addition to spending for the Pentagon and domestic agencies and sorting out dozens of policy battles, give a divided, dysfunctional Congress plenty of chances to stumble. The $1.1 trillion-plus catch-all bill, which faces a December 11th deadline, would ensure the government stays open. Spending amounts are relatively easy to sort out, helped in great measure by extra billions of dollars. However, Republicans who control both the House and Senate are sure to try squeeze agencies like the IRS and Environmental Protection Agency, while Democrats will defend domestic departments and press priorities such as infrastructure grants, preschool education, and money for local police and other first responders. And then there's Planned Parenthood. Tea Party Republicans are insisted on stripping the group of its federal funds for its practice of collecting and distributing fetal tissue for scientific research. Former Speaker John Boehner's refusal to risk a government shutdown over Planned Parenthood money was a precipitating factor in his being forced out last month. Also troublesome are dozens of GOP policy revisions that seek to reverse a slew of regulations issued by the Obama administration. In past negotiations, Republican efforts to attach divisive policy riders to the spending bill have been thwarted not only by Obama's veto threat, but Democrats who run the Senate. The balance of power has shifted. It's clearly go better because we do hold the Senate, said Representative Tom Cole, Republican Oklahoma. Oklahoma, who chairs the panel responsible for contentious labor, health, and education issues. The ones who have the best chance to make it will be the ones that actually have some Democratic support as well. Not all these things are simply partisan. End of this article. End of part two. Wednesday, November 4th, 2015. This is Debbie signing off. See you next week.